Welcome to the Fabric Podcast. Maybe you've noticed this, but it seems like people can be so people-y, right? That messiness of togethering can be a challenge, but it's also what makes life so rich. These weeks, we're making space for the stories of fabric folks that may do a lot of things, but hopefully will help you more deeply connect to one another, to your truest self, and to the divine. In this episode, you might notice a little technical difficulty. Sorry about that. But you'll hear some thoughts from Melissa Locke and stories from Stephen Taylor and Bjorn Westgaard that make it all worth it.
So, I'm heading to a job interview. And the roads are icy. It's one of those Minnesota winter mornings that are very cold. We get a lot of those. And the traffic is bad. And I'm late. And I'm going to 46 and Bryant. There used to be a cafe there, Studio 2 Cafe. And I'm flustered, and I get there, and I take a deep breath. Because the dude that's interviewing me looks a lot like the dude from The Big Lebowski. Glorious head of hair and everything. And to put that into some context, he actually used to be the lead guitarist for a semi-famous hair metal band, and his stage name was Nicky Wicked. That's Nicky with two C's, and two K's in Wicked. So I get through this interview somehow, and he offers me the job on the spot. And this is all seeming very normal to me for some reason, except when I get up and he gets up, I go to shake his hand, and he does it. And this is pre-COVID. And he says, dude, I don't want to shake your hand. I've got pneumonia. And this comment is sticking with me over the weekend when I'm trying to decide whether I'm going to take the job or not. And it's not that I'm worried about he's contagious or not. He was taking antibiotics. But something was off. And I'm going to skip over the sleepless nights and the soul searching I did and tell you I took the job. Nicky Wicked. Right? Well, there were other reasons. The location was awesome, and it was a good opportunity for me. So, fast forward to another very cold Minnesota morning. We get a lot of those. And I'm driving to my new job, and I'm giving myself this time plenty of time to get there. I arrive on the nose. I get there, but the dude's not there. I have two emails sitting in my inbox. The first is from him, and it says, antibiotics aren't working at the hospital. Spoiler, it wasn't pneumonia that we were dealing with. It was cancer. But we didn't know that. I didn't know that. He didn't know that. What we knew was that he was very sick. And the second message that I got was also from him, and it said simply, are you comfortable speaking in front of other dudes? Now, me being new on the job, I want to impress. And I'm a fabric guy, right? He's in the hospital. I want to help. What's my role? If he needs me to lead a meeting or do a sales presentation, gosh darn it, I'm there for him. So I type, sure. Hit send. A few minutes later, I get this email back, and it says, that's awesome. I appreciate you stepping in because I'm scheduled to MC at a conference tomorrow. Deets below. Okay, if you're not hearing what's wrong with that, I'm going to repeat that. I'm MCing at a conference tomorrow. Deets below. So he is an internationally renowned speaker. Me? No. Him, been on the conference circuit for years. Me, never spoken at a conference in my life. This is a highly technical, specialized conference. Me, new on the job, no idea what they're going to be talking about. And then finally, I have this recurring nightmare where I'm thrust on stage, and I have no idea what my lines are. Hello, nightmare. So it's a good thing that I hadn't turned down that other job offer that I had received. Because I walked in that next morning, bright and early, and I stand up tall, and I say, I am not the dude. But you know what? I say that to a room full of 400 people. I was at the conference. And I'm saying that because I'm not thinking they're going to mistake me for him. He's like 3 inches taller than me, long hair, deep booming voice. I'm saying that for myself because I'm showing up as me. And you know what? For that day, at least, it was enough. At least I did get invited back. The dude, he sadly never made it back to that conference. He made his final exit not long after. He was a giant of a mensch, a catalyst for the community. And I know I'm not alone in saying that I still miss him. I went on to do a lot of interesting things at that conference, both as MC and chair, like bring in speakers to talk about how to make technology more diverse and represent underrepresented groups and marginalized communities, and how to build sustainability into technology. Shameless plug, we're actually still doing that. If you Google Code Freeze in the University of Minnesota Software Engineering Center, you'll find the conference. Unofficial announcement because the details have not yet been released, but pay attention as they will be soon. You know, sometimes I think I was fated to do that conference. And other times I think I was just destined to show up as myself in some really messy and challenging life situations, no matter where they are. And maybe that's enough. Either way, thank you.
Oh my gosh, thank you, Stephen. I am not the dude. I'm willing to bet we have these stories working in us too. Like, I am not the dude. I am not the one. Why did I say yes to this? What am I supposed to be doing? But there was this story that came out of that uncertain situation that maybe this time it is enough to show up as me. So that's an example of a story we can trust, right? Thank you, Stephen. What are stories we can trust? I think they always offer us a more generous sense of who we are than we might afford ourselves. I think they offer meaning without certainty, without boxes, without limiting. I think they don't require conformity. They see uniqueness. They don't say there are some people who are winners and some who are losers. They see us, they see people, these people-y people, and they say, yes, yeah, do it, you can do it. So I bet you have your version of stories that you can trust like that, and I bet you have the others, the little monkeys and the outside stories that say, be very afraid, right? There's not enough, you're not enough. Different versions of that. And that's, again, why we're here practicing together, to hear different things reflected back to us and help us come back to those stories that we know are worthy of our trust. It was interesting that so many people that I asked and I thought, I cannot wait, I would love to hear them tell a story, they would say, well, why would anyone want to hear my particular story for this series? And there was a theologian named Frederick Buechner, who wrote a memoir called Telling Secrets. And he asked that very same question. Why would someone want to hear my particular story with all the warts and all the particular, you know, all the details? Like, it doesn't seem that interesting. But he said it's actually exactly in those particulars that we also see ourselves. So we find something about ourselves in someone else's story. And not only that, Buechner said that that is how God makes God's self known, in a real way. So there are these universal truths, these universal things about love and life and this big vision for this world that's always being created anew. There are these big truths, and we can hear about them as ideas. We can hear about, I love you because I love you because I love you. But the way it gets into us is because someone loves us here and now. Like, we feel it, we experience it in a local way, as Chris Lillehei talked about at the Falls a couple weeks ago. We need to feel it through particular people, through our, and live it through our particular stories. So these particular stories, our people-y stories, matter. And it's we're just so much poorer when we are too busy to stop and notice and stop and listen to the particular stories that are all around us every day, even outside in the world, in the leaves on the sidewalk, in the particular face in front of us at breakfast that is so easy to overlook in our busy morning. So that's why we get together and we practice noticing and pausing, and we practice sharing our stories. And because sometimes it can be hard to share something that matters to you, share how you're really doing, how you're really feeling. But I want to help you think about your own sacred stories, and that word sacred, I wonder what that means. I don't know what that means to you. But I suggest that if a story matters deeply to you, it's probably sacred. I expect that one of these phrases will pop out at you and you'll say, yeah, that. I relate to that. As you start wondering, what are my sacred stories that I trust, that I lean on, that I've learned from? So I'm going to read, you might want your pen, and choose one thing that jumps out. There is a depth to story that we rarely take time to ponder, let alone tell and hear. Story is how we transform pain. Story is how we make something useful out of the absurd. A sacred story is a love letter expanding your heart with kindness. A sacred story is a treasure box filled with images of what matters most. A sacred story is a map passed down through generations, directing you toward a fountain of truth. A sacred story is a medicine, a balm to relieve your fear and suffering. A sacred story is an angel in the night. A sacred story is a window that offers perspective. Sometimes a sacred story is a shield, a protector, a source of courage and love. Sometimes your sacred story is what gives you strength to face the real and present dangers of our world. Sometimes your sacred story spends years searching for you, trailing you through all your hairy days, cornering you in some blue fluorescent rehab center, looking you in the eye and saying, okay, here's the truth.
So I'm an ER doc, and I teach ER docs. And I will tell you that there's nobody smarter than a resident who's about to graduate. But when you start practicing, all the things that come so easily during your training suddenly become hard. And I know when I started practicing, I suddenly did not feel very smart. When I finished residency, part of my job was and still is to go out to rural Minnesota and Wisconsin and work in smaller town ERs. And I thought, I come from a smaller town in Wisconsin, I should be able to handle this, but instead I felt kind of alone. I was used to this large urban hospital, and here I am in small hospitals where if there's a delivery or somebody's heart stops, I'm responsible for all of it, and I figure I'm gonna have to be the dude. I'm gonna have to be the person who shows people how it's done. But I would listen to the conversations of my new colleagues and, you know, talking about hunting and pole barns, and I would just kind of wonder about their skill set and whether I would be able to relate them to them. So one of those first days that I was out, this woman comes in to one of these small ERs, very anxious, has a history of panic attacks, and I remember someone kind of walking around muttering, you know, frequent ER visits. And so I did sort of this cursory interview and exam, and I gave her some medicine for her anxiety. And I was a little bit annoyed that I'd already met one of these familiar faces in this ER. But after a little while, one of these nurses comes up to me and she says, she didn't look so good. And she goes, you know, she's had a lot of stress lately, and one of her family members died last week. And in rural, small-town ERs, everybody knows everybody. And I was like, let's give it a minute. We just gave her some medicine. Let's see how she does. And then one of the healthcare techs came around and said, I don't know, do you think this could be more than anxiety? And so I kind of did a eye roll and a sigh, and I said, okay, well, let's check things out. So I did an ECG, and I looked at this heart tracing, see if maybe her heart was going on, because she had some chest sensations going on with this, and it looked a little wrong. And so then I did a blood test for the heart, and it was also like a little abnormal, and I'm like, oh man, this is going to be my first heart attack that I see outside of training, and I potentially missed it. So I asked them, you know, to pull out this ultrasound, which is something we use frequently, but they had this first generation ultrasound, size of a washing machine, screens about this big, and I start looking at her heart with this ultrasound, which is not used very much, and so everybody kind of crowds around me, and I'm looking at her heart, and it doesn't look right either, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm seeing, and as I'm staring there, the tech on my right side goes, doesn't look that like that end of her heart's working very well. And then the nurse over my left shoulder is like, yeah, that doesn't seem like that's doing anything. And all of a sudden it kind of hits me. They had just called out this pattern of a Japanese octopus catching pot, which is the signature pattern of Takotsubo's cardiomyopathy, which is an emotional, stress-driven, adrenaline-driven heart attack that's pretty rare. And so I explain this to the patient, talk about our next steps, and I start making arrangements for her to go to the Twin Cities. And as part of that, I call a cardiologist, and I tell him, you know, what we just found. And he pauses, and he goes, where are you calling from? And in the process, you know, I could hear his dismissal of this place and everybody who was working there and living there. And that includes me, all of us who had just sat and made this rare diagnosis together. And I could hear an echo of my own dismissal. And I felt pretty stupid. So the patient got transferred, did well, diagnosis was confirmed. But I understood after that I wasn't supposed to be the dude. I didn't have to show everybody how it was done. I was supposed to show up and trust and listen and share and do my part. And that's what I do. That was over a decade ago, and I work in rural and urban ERs still. And I've gotten to know and love all my colleagues in many places, and I love sitting with colleagues and patients and hearing their stories and where they're from and their lives. And when I work in the cities too. And it's those ties that keep us sane. They've kept us sane through the dark days of COVID. And even now where we're faced with staffing issues and burnout, and sicker patients. It's those ties that keep me showing up. I go to work for the people. I keep showing up for the people who keep showing up with me.
Thanks for listening. We hope this podcast sparks conversation in other parts of your life. If you're looking for meaningful connections, there's a Fabric group for you to try, whether you're in the Twin Cities or not. Tag @FabricMPLS with your wonderings on social media and find resources on our website, fabricmpls.com.